Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everybody to another episode of Down, Under and Up. I'm Henry Draper with my co-host Kelsey Lynn Brown here, and we are reporting what is wonderful today with someone that is doing something wonderful with the all natural environment, which is what we're focused on doing here with the new presentation. And so we support the real food, real air, and real water, which is one of the things that permaculture encompasses. And Morag here today, Morag Gamble, she's been doing permaculture for over 25 years. She's taught in 20 countries where she's worked with local communities, collaborating and designing public spaces with edible gardens and food forests. She particularly loves working with women and children, and over 50% of her work is dedicated to community in need through her registered charity, the Ethos Foundation. And she recently returned from Uganda and Kenya, mentoring local permaculture teachers and distributing funds directly to local permaculture centers. And we're grateful today to also have Morag's children on with us. And they're going to share some experiences that they've had growing up in the Crystal Waters Eco Village and from their travels with Morag around the world. So I did a permaculture course a few years ago in New Zealand. I'm from New Zealand. I did that with Gary and Emily Williams. And a lot of people ask me, you know, what is permaculture? And I don't know how to explain it in a few sentences. So hi, Morag, thanks for joining us. If you'd like to introduce yourself a little bit more and maybe explain to our listeners who haven't heard of permaculture, maybe a nice definition of what that is.
Hi, Henry. How are you going? Well,
yeah, good thing.
I'm here with my daughter, actually, Maya. Hugh, who was going to be on the show, ended up going up the valley with some friends. So I'm sorry he can't be here with us. But Maya, my 12-year-old daughter, is. So she's here ready and waiting to share as well. So I've been involved in permaculture for, maybe 25 years or so now. Permaculture essentially is about designing sustainable ways of living, thinking about, you know, how are we actually meant to live if we think we just have one Earth? Because typically, so you're Australian, right? And I guess I'm calling in to the show that's being run out of the States, I think. If you think about people who live in the standard way of life in America and in Australia, if everyone in the world lived like the typical Australian or the typical American, we would need five Earths to support our way of life, to meet our needs and wants, and to absorb the waste that we create as a result of our lifestyle in general. But we only have one Earth. So what does one Earth living look like? How are we to start to move towards that in countries like Australia and the States and Europe and all the sort of developed or overdeveloped nations? What does that mean? And how can we, it's not just about going backwards, but how can we move forward in a way that really makes a lot of sense and a way that we can thrive? But on the flip side too, permaculture is a way of designing for resilience, for local sustainability, for sustainable development in places like Africa and India and Indonesia, and actually raising the standard and the quality of life where access to resources has been limited, and largely because of the overconsumption of people in the overdeveloped parts of the world. So really it's about trying to create balance. It's using design. It's being really ethical. The underlying ethical principles of permaculture are earth care, people care, and fair share. So that's pretty much a really good synopsis, I think, of what it's all about. The earth care, people care, fair share. So what are we doing with our life that's, you know, caring for the earth? Is everything that we're doing actually restore and regenerate is what we're doing, actually supporting people, not just the people around us, but our neighbours and our community and people on the other side of the planet. And is what we're doing actually contributing to the fair share of resources and helping people in other parts of the world to access the things that they need to live and thrive, and also other species and ecosystems that all life has access to the resources that they need to live. So it's designing essentially sustainable human habitats so I hope that's kind of like a bit of a broad overview of what permaculture is, and does that help you to kind of get a picture of what permaculture is about?
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful way of explaining it to our listeners. Thank you. Yeah. So do you think you could talk a little bit more about your recent trip to Uganda and Kenya and what you're doing there with the local communities?
Sure. Maya and Hugh, my two oldest children, came to Uganda and Kenya for a month in December. And we were invited there to help mentor some young permaculture teachers. So up until that point, the permaculture teaching in those areas had only ever really been run by overseas people. And there's this group of young people over there who are saying, yeah, this makes a lot of sense to us and we reckon we can do it, but we just need someone to kind of mentor us. We don't want you to teach it. We don't want you to take over. We just want you to be there to support us and help us through. So each day, so I helped them to plan the program. I sort of gave them feedback and input on that. And then at each end of each day, I was helping to sort of them to reflect on what they were doing, how they could improve their course, maybe plan the next day and kind of keep on track with it all. And so now, after having done that, they feel really confident to go out and, you know, start teaching their own courses independently, which is what people want to be able to do. They don't want to be dependent on other people from other places to ripple this out. And again, in that way, it always ends up being a little bit more of a kind of an eco-colonial type approach. So this is supporting local people in local communities to do stuff which makes sense to them and in a way that they can ripple out continuously without anyone else necessarily having to be there. So that was one side of it. And Maya and you came and participated in that course. And actually, as a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old, they graduated with their permaculture design certificate courses, certificates, being taught by people from Uganda and Kenya and Liberia, and there was people there from Tanzania and Zimbabwe. So, and mostly adults too. There was a couple of other kids from the local school. So that was a fantastic experience for them to be able to be part of that. And I remember one of them saying, I can't remember if it was Hugh or Maya, was saying, hey, Mum, we actually know most of this stuff. And I thought, they've never actually ever been taught all that stuff about permaculture. They've just grown up with it. We live in an eco-village, a permaculture eco-village. I've been teaching permaculture since, I think, when Maya was born. As soon as I could, she was in a sling, I was still teaching permaculture. So it's kind of just, she's been immersed in it her whole life. So whether she knows it or not, it's just kind of gone in. So they were fantastic participants and designers as part of the course. And I know that when they were doing group work, they're really able to help offer like a lot of insights and design examples because they've seen permaculture in action. So I think it was easy for them to, like, as group participants, to help kind of be tutors, I suppose, in and amongst it. So other sorts of things we're doing in Africa, there's a place called the African Children's Choir, and they support children who come, like, often out of slums to learn more about their culture and about singing, and they get to go and perform, and through this embracing of culture, they are able to get an education. And this school actually wanted to start up a farm, and they've started a bit of a farm, but they wanted to do a more sort of permaculture approach and make sure that a lot of the food that they grow there gets put straight into the children's meals, And also that the kids who are there learning about permaculture at the same time, so when they go back home to their villages, they can kind of share that with their families to help. Because what's happening over there is pretty much most of the villages are reliant on chemicals, on fertilizers, on imported seeds. The soil, which used to be really rich and healthy, has been degraded. The waterways are being polluted. The income that the farmers are getting is going down because the cost of the imports is going up. I mean, it's the same story everywhere. So they're looking for a different way, a more sustainable way of growing their food and actually, you know, generating an income from it. So we went and we did a 2-day introduction workshop with these kids and actually sort of went through a lot of the background information about what permaculture is all about, and then got in and did actually transform part of their school grounds in a day. And so the kids knew what they're doing, why they're doing it, and got the skills to actually set up some garden areas so that now that's going to be carried on. And we sponsored one of the teachers to be part of the bigger course so that he can go back and help to maintain it and keep on developing it and designing it even further. And then we were out in the far-flung places of Western Kenya over long, bumpy roads in a little village not far from the Kakamega Forest, which is one of the ancient forests in that area. And there's a group of women there who are looking at trying to find a way to create local employment using sustainable farming methods. And so we ran a very short workshop there about seed saving in particular and sustainable design, like a component of permaculture, and connected with them and looked at, you know, talked about later this year actually supporting them to run a series of longer workshops. And so we're fundraising too to help them to get the seed funding to start up a whole lot of like a demonstration farm of permaculture that they can help, that they're helping their neighbours and community to create more sustainable farming. So there's, you know, stuff with women, stuff with kids, stuff with schools, a whole lot of different programs that we were running there. And, you know, it's only been a month or so since we've got back, and I think I'm still kind of trying to get my head around what it is that happened over there. It was really quite extraordinary and really challenging at the same time. I don't know if you've been to Africa, but, you know, I've worked with permaculture in 22 different countries and been in lots of different contexts, but I don't know if I'd been anywhere quite so undeveloped and, I don't know, in some ways, you know, like there's some parts that I just felt like I'd stepped back into medieval times. It was really quite extraordinary. But at the same time, you know, like if people have access to land and access to be able to, you know, some water to be able to grow food, it's kind of remarkable how the quality of life that you can create without any resources whatsoever. So even without running water or electricity, you know, people are still getting on doing their thing. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what Maya felt about it. I know it was probably fairly hard going part of it. But she's also had the chance to go to Indonesia and South Korea before doing permaculture programs. So, yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Maya? What did you think about Africa?
It's a lot different to what a usual life in first world countries is. I didn't actually know what to expect when I went over there. But if I did expect something, it was probably a lot different from that. So...
yeah. So what did you, when you were out in the villages, what was your impression? Like when we got out to the school, like Sabina school, and we were there.
Well, it's a very different way of living. Like they have to do all their food from scratch with water from a pump that might actually not be clean. So they have to boil the water and it's a lot longer process. But it's very inspiring because they keep going on and doing their life as normal, but they've got a lot harder stuff to do. So it's very.
It was really one of the things that struck me the most about, there was this one particular school. It was a boarding school where we were at, and the landscape there is being used to set up a demonstration permaculture place, and so there was some really interesting, examples there from a food forest, herb gardens, worm farms. Permaculture has been happening there for a while. For some reason, this particular school seems to have attracted a lot of permaculture attention over the years. But the one thing that struck me the most was this mound, absolute huge mound of firewood. And it was enormous, wasn't it? And then I realized, well, that's actually what they're using to cook all the food with. And when you stop and you think about, well, if every single person just about throughout most of the parts of Africa are either cooking on charcoal or wood, what impact that is having. So I think I've sort of come away with the idea of, you know, if there's anything that I could offer going back into Africa again, one would be seeds, because they have to pretty much buy seeds. So looking at seed saving, community seed bank, and I know that rippling out that is a really important thing to do. But the other one is looking at different ways of cooking and preparing food, because, you know, burning so much wood can only be damaging the sort of the foundation of their ecosystem and the natural support system that they have, and the hydrological cycles and the soil and, you know, erosion, everything is impacted by that. But I think what Maya was saying about the food coming from scratch, you know, that there's a lot of the women that I was speaking to there do have a really strong sense about food, the importance of food coming from local areas and coming straight from the farm, and that it being so much more healthier. You know, the thing too about anything that's processed food is typically just absolute rubbish over there and packed in tiny little packages with lots of plastic. And, you know, when you're there, you realise that there is no way. I think here in Australia you can, and, you know, other first world countries, we very nicely tidy up around us and have landfills which we can send things. So we don't have to look at the impact of our way of life. But over there, there is no way. You know, if you get something into your system that's wrapped in plastic, it stays in your system. You either have to burn it or bury it, but mostly it just kind of gets tossed. And so there it is. I mean, that was a really big thing, wasn't it? The plastics everywhere.
Yeah.
And that kind of shows, I guess, the bumping up between the industrial society and the non-industrial society, how, it was really quite confronting the plastic waste, and particularly plastic bottles. I don't know how many mountains of plastic drink bottles that we saw everywhere. And, you know, you hear these statistics about, you know, what are the biggest plastic problems we have are plastic bottles and plastic drink straws and plastic bags. For Kenya started a bag ban, and you can't actually go and buy anything and come away from a shop with a plastic bag. That's not possible anymore. But the bottles were just everywhere. And, I guess the thing too is, because of the water pollution, actually be able to source local fresh water in your stream. So thinking about water runoff, grey water systems, water contamination, drinking water purification systems, all of these things I think were really big lessons, I think, for me. Thinking about appropriate technologies, you know, everything has to be really affordable, doable, shareable, able to be done with absolutely small amount of resources and, you know, just about no money. And if you want to set something up, then, you know, you need to sort of find some startup funding so then it can kind of ripple out, but never to try and create anything that's going to just create dependence, so that, you know, if you set up a system, some so-called expert has to come in and fix it up, and it costs a whole lot of money, which gets people into a sort of another trap. So there's this promise of something better, but it actually ends up being more of a noose around their neck. So, yeah, a lot of lessons, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like a great trip. And I actually visited Tanzania and a little bit of Kenya when I was a teenager with a friend from high school. And yeah, it was very different, not just the way people live, but just the way people are. There's always people walking on the streets. They're very friendly, and it's a very different culture to what I grew up with in New Zealand. And even traveling to other countries, I've traveled quite a lot since I left high school. to 30 odd countries or something like that. And yeah, but Africa is very different. And like you said, their way of living is very different, but they still get on. They still survive just in a very different fashion. And it can be done, like you said, without all the technologies that we have. But at the moment, I understand that a lot of these people are struggling somewhat because of what the industrialized capitalist society has kind of imposed on these people, as you mentioned, with the degraded soils and things. So, but yeah, it can work. Like the indigenous peoples of the earth, they all survived okay, and they made sense of things, and they supported the natural environment, and it supported them. And this is why permaculture is so wonderful, because it's a way for people to kind of go back to the simplicity of just supporting what supports you. And yeah, it's cool and it's fun, and that's what we're promoting here. We have all solar research vessel projects and sustainable communities projects as well for, different parts of the world. And I was hoping you could share more, like how, and Maya too, how you guys live in an eco village there in Crystal Water. And if you could share, how life is there, and maybe how, from what you've learned, how you could implement these systems, or how you see people could, use what you've learned and how you guys live as a way for people to live in other eco villages in different parts of the world, or just different parts of Australia.
Sure. So what do you think about living here, Maya? You've grown up here. She's a born and bred eco-villager.
Yeah, well, it's a very good way of a lifestyle because you're just immersed in wildlife and open spaces, clean air, fresh water. Just, it's kind of a free way of living, and it's just my normal way of life. I just do.
So just grown up with the, so all the houses have been designed to be as sort of low impact as possible. Crystal Waters itself, we're in the Sunshine Coast hinterland of Australia, which is in the southeast Queensland. So the whole property is about 640 acres, and there's about 250 people living here. It's been going for about 30 years now, and so each household essentially has about an acre that's their plot. So the bit that we kind of own and manage as families or households is only 14% of the land, and the rest of the land is common land. And I think this is a really important thing, because one of the biggest issues that we face in society today is the fact that most of our commons have been enclosed, that we don't have, the open common space for us to be able to share resources, share farms, share, forests. That was a traditional indigenous way, if you think about how Australia was before, that everything was the commons. There was no private ownership of any one particular part. So the idea here is that most of it's in common ownership, and we look after it together and manage it together. So on my 1 acre that I look after, I've built a sort of done an owner building of a house, and so we have a compost toilet, dry composting toilet, solar power, solar hot water system, local materials, as much as we could in terms of building, and then just looking at designing it so that it relates to the landscape and to the aspect and the slope, and making sure that we get as much daylighting and natural ventilation and cooling. So there's all that kind of stuff that's designed as part of the home. So there's lots of different materials from local timbers to rammed earth and mud brick, cob, poured earth, straw bale. So it's an interesting thing to come and see all the different houses, but it's also a really interesting thing to come look at all the different toilets too, because there's so many different sorts of composting toilets, from the dry composting toilets to the flush composting toilets to the batch composting toilets. And the whole idea is there's no pipes that come into Crystal Waters bringing in water from outside, and there's no pipes taking our waste away. So So we have to kind of think about that when we design our landscape and our lifestyle. And I think, you know, Maya may not realize it because she's just grown up in it, but the idea that you live within the natural limits. So we only have, you know, tank water that's available to us. And so we have short showers and we're conservative in our use of water. You know, when we want to have a swim, we go down to the local river. We don't have our own personal pools, for example. You know, thinking really about how we can minimize our personal impact on the landscape and diminish our need for resources. And as I was saying before, our ecological footprint is so huge now that as a typical Australian, you need five Earths. So one Earth living means we need to be able to reduce our needs and our impact by about 80%. And what does that look like? And I guess that's what we've tried to show and demonstrate here. And so we've set up this place and we've quite often open it up for tours and workshops and classes, and we have school camps coming in and all different sorts of things to kind of demonstrate, well, you know, here's kind of like quite a modern looking house. However, it is completely different when you look at the kind of the fundamental design of it and the features and the impact of it. So Krista Waters has, as I said, 250 people, and there's about 83 households. So all the different houses are slightly different and all been pretty much owner built. And then on the common land, we have interesting different, I'll just come back to the 1 acre lot. So in and around our homes, we have our permaculture gardens, because that's kind of where you put your kitchen garden, right next to your home. So all the waste that comes out of the house, like your compost, and your grey water goes directly into your landscape, and that then grows your food. And then further afield in the common land, we have shared things. So there's a shared woodlot, for example, which is, you know, we need some timber to construct our chicken house, for example. So we've got chooks here. Then you go down to the woodlot and you talk to the woodsman, and he'll take out some, you know, he'll sustainably harvest some timber that you need. And then further down, there's some river flats where we have a shared little dairy space. There's a few cows and there's about 10 families or so who work together to manage that. So what it means is that once every, I don't know, 2 weeks, it's our turn to go down and look after the cows. And so we milk the cows and take care of them that day, bring it home, and then we get to sort of make our cheeses and yogurts and what else do we make? You make a really nice halloumi, and what else do you make? Ricotta?
Paneer.
Yeah. So we don't have to be dairy people, or we don't have to be beekeepers, or we don't have to be, you know, everything to be self-sufficient. We work collaboratively as a community to do that. So there's, you know, someone on the next ridge who does the beekeeping, and there's someone around the corner who, you know, would do soap making, or someone else who, you know, everyone does different bits and pieces. And so it works like that. You know, it's this community self-reliance system as opposed to this idea of, I guess, the homesteader where you feel like you need to do everything. And I think it's more like a traditional sustainable village in that way. And it's not to say that everyone participates in everything. Some people are more into sort of the cultural arts and music side of things, and they're not growers at all, and that's fine, because there are other people who are. And around the corner, we kind of look more bioregionally as well. So we look at what's going on in our neighboring farms. Not far from us, there's a guy who has a beautiful land right on the river flats, and he grows lots of all the, you know, lots of the salad greens and veggies that supplement what people aren't able to grow here, or don't, because they're doing something else. You know, their work is something else. And so he opens up as a farm gate stall, and people pop down there. And there's also another farm opposite from him where they have, you know, people who eat meat can go there, and they can get their, they actually humanely raise and care for organic animals there. So there's kind of all different sorts of things going on in terms of the food system, as well as a local food cooperative. Mullaney itself, which is our local town, is an amazing local cooperative town. So we have a local bank that's all sustainable finance. Underneath that was started the local LET system. So community currencies, it's, food co-ops, art co-ops, community clubs, all the sort of social and economic kind of things that you need to support a thriving culture, but without it being through that kind of capitalist model. It's more of the community collaborative approach. So there's kind of people of all ages and backgrounds. Like I said, Maya grew up here, so there's always young kids here. When they were little, I was involved in helping to run we had a little eco play group. We had little gardens and we cooked up stuff and we did music clubs and it's pretty great. My kids have grown up out of that now, but now there's new parents doing that. So there's kids from all ages, from newborns. Actually, there's one newborn that's about 5 days old now, and I think the eldest resident, he must be over 90 now, one of the original residents. And what I'm finding is really interesting now is that as it's been here for 30 years, so people have left, young people have grown up and they've left, but they're actually coming back. They've gone, they've travelled the world, they've gone and lived in the big cities, and actually, you know, now that they're starting to hit their 30s, they're going, oh, you know, I actually really, really loved that place that I grew up in. And they're starting to come back and bring their partners and bringing their kids, like starting to have families and realizing that this is a pretty awesome place to grow a family and to reconnect with community and to create all that sort of cultural stuff that they were seeking. But right here in the midst of this kind of amazing, amazing ecological space, like Maya was saying, being surrounded by nature, it's peaceful, it's calm, but it's connected. We have people from all around the world coming here. Where have we have woofers come and stay with us? Where are the summer places we've had woofers from?
Well, we've had some from Australia, but they've mainly been from other countries. Some was from France, Spain, Belgium,
Colombia,
all over the place.
China, Japan. And so what's been great about that is it's an opportunity to interact with people from around the world, but at the same time, learn different. Like when Maya was homeschooling for a few years, every time someone would come in new, we'd learn about a different culture, a different place, and do some bit of a language thing, and meet people that we could go and visit in different parts of the world too. So, you know, if we want to go exploring, you know, there's people and places we can go to. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, we live in a gift. People come and work with us, and in exchange for them coming, they, you know, they get their food and accommodation. That's kind of the woof thing. With our cows, you know, we don't pay for milk and cheese and yogurt and all of that sort of stuff. We just work together with people to make that kind of stuff happen. And so what I'm finding is you're actually able to live on much less money but have a really high quality of life, because you've got great local organic food and you have the time actually to get involved in doing that and creating community, like, and also getting involved in sort of activism. Tonight, for example, there's a community meal a couple of doors up from us. It's kind of like a house party with a big, it's part of the activism movement against the Adani mines that are in Australia. And so our community is coming together and we're going to, that's sort of part of our stand against that. There's other things that we get together and make a community stand against things outside of Crystal Waters too, because I think that's a really important part, that we're not just in our little local bubbles. We're actually part of a global community that has global challenges. And I'm really excited at the moment by the students movement that's going on, the school strikes that are happening, where, you know, 20,000, 30,000 kids are striking each time they do one of these events. I was just talking to a young woman in Europe and saying that, they do it every Friday and they get 20,000 to 30,000 kids stepping out of school to say, we're really worried about what's happening in the world. Climate change is happening and we're not going to stop striking from school until the government, until it takes notice of what we're saying and cares about our future and actually puts in some proper strategies in place to make changes now. And so why I'm saying that is because I think you can live here in this community and just have a really nice quiet life. But at the same time, I really feel that there's this strong sense of commitment and responsibility to make a stand against what's going on, like the bigger picture, what's happening in the world and how you can really make a change from a platform like this. And to not just say, I don't like what's happening, that needs to change, but actually to go, okay, well, I don't like that. So, but if you don't like that, what is another way of life? Well, come and have a look over here. This is another way of living. This is an alternative. This is how, if more people kind of took the lessons from places like Crystal Waters and other eco-villages and community farms and permaculture programs, you know, we could make an enormous difference. The examples already exist. We don't need, I get a little bit frustrated when I hear, you know, there's all this rhetoric about, you know, we need to change and here's the policies, but we're not quite sure what we need to do yet. Like, there's a whole lot of examples of what we need to do. We just need to open our eyes and look out. And so what I try and do is actually to speak as loudly as I can in many different platforms and forums that I can to say, not in an aggressive way, but in a really positive way, say, look, you know, this is a possibility. This is happening. This is happening really well. And it's a really great way to live. And it's a really healthy and positive and low impact way to live. And, you know, this is how we got going and this is how you can do it. So you don't have to live in an eco-village to do this, for example. I mean, David Holmgren, one of the founders of permaculture, has written a new book recently called Retro Suburbia. And he's re-explaining the whole kind of concept of permaculture, but from a suburban perspective where, you know, most people in places like Australia live in not in the downtown urban areas and not out in the countryside, but right, you know, in the areas in and around the cities. So it is about the same kind of thing. It's about sharing. It's about collaborating. It's about looking for local food. It's about supporting ethical ways of living. It's about retrofitting your home and trying to think about how you can reduce your impact by 80%. And a lot of that's not got to do with the physical stuff, the technological fixes. It's really got to do with our attitudes, the choices that we make every day. And that is where the big change needs to happen, in our minds and in our hearts. And if we choose to live differently and we choose to communicate positively and we choose to do what we do and to demonstrate that as a possibility and invite people to be part of this positive revolution, then I think we kind of can shift things. People need to see that it is possible, and they need to see that it's real, and need to see that it's something they could do. And there are so many examples out there. And, you know, like you guys setting up this, you know, podcast, radio show so that people can learn about different ways is fantastic. You know, there's so many different mediums that we can communicate the positive change that needs to happen and share the good news stories and get off the mainstream media and get onto the media where people are actually sharing this stuff. I think it's a really, really positive thing to do.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. That was really cool. Thanks for sharing. And, yeah, we think it's so cool. Kelsey and I are here listening to you saying it just sounds so wonderful where you live. And I've visited some nice places too, like eco-villages, and it is so nice to just be surrounded by the natural environment. It's so natural because, you know, it's natural what we're living in here, where everybody's rushed in this crazy world that is destroying the natural environment that supports us. It's unnatural and it doesn't make any sense. So it makes sense what you're doing, and we're having fun sharing it. And I actually had my first permaculture experience woofing myself. I think I had just turned 20 and I was in Mexico, and it was just so fun. And I had no idea really. I mean, I had the idea, but I hadn't experienced it. So I didn't really understand what it's like to just get in the garden every day and grow your own food and eat the food that you grow. And you actually have a lot more time to do other stuff. Like, we would go swimming in cenotes, which are underground caves in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. And I did some woofing in Costa Rica and Nicaragua and the U.S. and in New Zealand too. And yeah, it's just so cool. And that's when I did my permaculture course, as I wanted to further my understanding. And I can totally see the view that Maya had of how she didn't learn a whole lot of new things in her permaculture course, because she's been doing it for so long. And in a lot of ways, permaculture just makes sense. It's kind of common sense. And once you learn it, it's like, oh yeah, of course I'm going to do that. Of course I'm going to do this. That's what makes sense. So it's very cool. Yeah, we really enjoyed listening and listening to that. And I was hoping Maya could share, you know, just a little bit more about like what she does like day by day for like for our listeners who can see the comparison of children in this modern society of how they kind of get up and they're rushed off to school and they get home and, you know, they're watching TV and they're eating GMO foods and eventually going to sleep to do it all again. Maybe Maya can share, you know, you said that she was homeschooling and maybe now she's not. Maybe she can talk about what it was like homeschooling too.
Well, basically my day is I just wake up, I feed the chickens and the guinea pigs and the fish and the cow sometimes, and we go and milk them on Wednesday mornings when I was homeschooling, and then I'd come back and I'd start doing some work on just online with different kind of websites that were based around extending your knowledge and stuff. And then there was also this extension education that we went to down the coast. And it was learning about the society and architecture and medieval times. And then, yeah, so
I think, you know, Maya's kind of struggling to think about what she wants to say, but I think, you know, say for example, if you want to go to a swimming pool, like where would you go if you want to go for a swim in the afternoon?
The river.
So you go to the river, yeah, and there's this beautiful natural river that's unpolluted and you can just dive on in. And there's another spot that you go swimming. Where is that?
It's a dam that's made for the habitat of the animals in the eco village. And there's a little rope swing there and we go off.
Yeah, yeah. So there's like 17 lakes and dams that have been created within Crystal Waters to moderate the microclimate, to keep water higher up in the landscape. But they also create this one particular one that we call the Big Dam because it's the biggest one. And it's good quality water for swimming. And the kids leave little kayaks on the side and, you know, often kids hear the other kids coming and they come down from, you know, like your friend Eleni, she comes down and you call up to her and you're just diving off. It's kind of very cool. You know, you don't have to, you know, there's no chlorine involved and it's just natural and it's so much fun doing it that kind of way. So she might do that on the market days. Do you want to talk about market and what you do? We have a little village green here that's right at the heart of the village. And the first Saturday of every month, there's a market day. So what happens on market day?
Well, since we live pretty close to the market area, we walk down. It's only about a kilometre or something. And there's all these stalls set up by local people. So it might be like some clothes that they'd made during the week or the month. And there's also a small organic vegetable store. There's a bakery down there as well that makes sourdough bread. And that's been going for quite a long time. They've also put all the mailboxes down there as well. So people go down to check their mail and it's kind of a community setting. So you can talk to people and go to the market while you're down there too. There's a cafe open up on the deck on the big area where they have performances and music going on. Sometimes I do a stall and set up for local produce or something. And then there's some plants for sale maybe, and all the kids go down there and there's this playground, so yeah.
So the kids just hang out, they might go down to the river, there's no cars, so it's yeah in the market area, so it's all free. I don't even know where the kids go, they just kind of go and do their thing and then eventually they'll come home later on. So there's that sense of freedom and security. And Maya said she had like a little stall, which is great because so she can generate some pocket money and then go and spend it on the stalls or go over to the bakery and buy one of the home cook's little things. And her brother Hugh also has stalls, but his big thing that he started was being the bike kid. So if someone has a flat tire or squeaky brakes or clunky gears, they give Hugh a call and they bring their bike over and he fixes it up, and that's how he generates his pocket money. And so this whole idea, and they were inspired to do these sorts of local enterprises after I went to this talk by Joel Salatin. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's an American farmer who's changed his farm from being a sort of a monoculture degraded farm into being this sort of multifaceted place that has so many different enterprises. His kids involved in from the early age, I think of 10 or something, doing their own enterprises. And at the time, I think Maya was 9 and Hugh was 7. They said, oh, we can do that. And so Maya set up a guinea pig enterprise and Hugh set up his bike enterprise. It was so, so cool. I think the first thing that Maya did was she set up, she's laughing now, she's kind of gone all shy, but she set up a guinea pig clothing company. But, you know, we can laugh about it, but you wouldn't believe it. Her and her friend set up a guinea pig fashion show, right? And so what they did was they took old clothing, bits and pieces of fabric that, you know, stuff that couldn't be used anymore, couldn't be given to the secondhand store. They couldn't kind of pass on to any friends. And then they chopped them up and they made them into little guinea pig clothes. And they set up this series of fashion shows at the market, and they sold tickets for people to come into their little tent to see their fashion show. They made $60 from a guinea pig fashion show on one day, these like little pipsqueaks of kids, and people loved it. And then she started developing up this idea of guinea pig or any kind of pet supplements, because we have lots of herbs growing out in our garden. So she would be harvesting and drying things like comfrey, grinding them up into a powder. And she even designed her own website to then look at how she could try and start to sell these guinea pig supplements. And so these are sorts of things that she was doing while she was homeschooling. And there were so many skills, as you can see in this, from everything from understanding herbalism, from understanding markets and community things. She also organized a cafe at the top of a pop-up cafe at the top of our block. So she took over our little carport area and turned it into a beautiful cafe. She would offer tea, and the tea was all teas that she'd harvest from the garden, and they were different sort of plunged things. And she also did do coffee, and so she learned how to do baristering, and we had a little coffee machine. It was all fair trade organic coffee with local milk, and so that's all awesome. And she made all this beautiful food that was locally done, and she, you know, gluten free and all sorts of things, raw options, and so she learned how to do marketing and cafe setup and all these sorts of things, and the community came over. And but what I really liked about what you did with that was that you also decided that you would give a proportion of your funds to an environmental project. And what were some of the environmental projects that you supported through your enterprise?
Well, there was a tree planting thing for the kids going down at the market space where they would plant some trees. And at that time, the group doing it, they needed money for the stakes to hold the tree up while it was growing and the things to protect it. So I raised some money for that, and we got about $30. And then there was also endangered species, which I was really into at that time. So I put a portion of the earning profit things into a space where WWF could get it. And I supported snowy owls and lynxes because they were critically endangered at that time. So, yeah.
Mm. So this sort of idea of integrating a love for nature, serving like community needs, and then thinking about all the different learnings that can come out of that. So just this last year, Maya and Hugh went back to school. Maya's now in year 9, and she got herself a scholarship to a local school, and so she just started that in the last couple of weeks. So that's been a whole new different way of living, but you know, I think she's really enjoying it. And then Maya's about to come with me over to Scotland and attend the climate change conference that'll have people like Vandana Shiva and Bill McKibben and Charles Eisenstein, all these amazing kind of leaders there, as well.
Hi everyone, sorry, we just had a communication issue with Morag. I'm just messaging her now so she can call back. I made the silly decision of hanging her up instead of muting her, so we'll see if she can come back. But one of the things I wanted to say, I did want Morag to hear it, that it's so cool to hear her and Maya's experiences, because we often talk about how it makes sense to support the all-natural environment that supports all of us, but we don't necessarily give a view of how it can actually be done. And so, yeah, like I said, it's so cool that Morag and her family and all the people in this village, that they're supporting the natural environment which makes sense, and they're sharing what they're doing with others, which is so cool. Are you there, Morag?
Yeah, we're back again. Yep.
Can you
hear us?
Cool. I was just saying. Yeah. Sorry, I'm not sure what happened, but. Yeah, you just kind of went all funny and we lost you. Well, I was just saying that it's so cool to have you guys share, because we often talk about how it makes sense to support the natural environment that supports us, but a lot of our listeners, they don't have the experience that you guys have, and they just see it as like almost like some kind of fantasy, what you guys are describing, because compared to where right now, we're in Huntington Beach, California. I'm from New Zealand, and Kelsey here is from the East Coast of the United States. And here in California, you know, everything is very industrial, and it's, you know, lots of big cities. The whole of Southern California is basically one big city, from LA to San Diego through Orange County, where we are. And yeah, people just, they don't really see how it can be so simple, and there's always something to do. You know, everybody's so kind of attached to their electronic devices here, and it's so nice to hear how Maya and her brother, there's always something to do. They'll run off, they'll find something, and they'll be creative too. Like Maya, you know, she's very entrepreneurial, and by the sounds of things, and she's not in it to just make money, like, and, you know, go and spend it on funny things that don't support the natural environment. She's actually using her well-earned money to support wonderful projects that do support the natural environment. So we're really impressed, and that's very cool. I'm sorry we lost you there, Maury, but you were saying that Maya is now she's not homeschooling anymore?
Yeah, no. So we homeschool for quite a few years, and that was absolutely fantastic. So now she's at a school, and we're about to go traveling for about 6 weeks to go to this climate change conference in Scotland. She's the youngest participant, and the school has gone, wow, that is so amazing. We love that. And so they've done interviews with her, and they want to share it with the school community. And then as they've learned that she's actually from this permaculture village, the teachers are starting to contact me and say, can we bring our students out and do camps out at your place? And so the fact that she's now in a sort of a mainstream school, she's taking with her, you know, these ideas, and they're going, well, that's incredible. We want to hear about it, and we want to share this with our school community. So I think it's a really important thing not to dismiss necessarily, and not to sort of put yourself into a bubble, but actually really to be as integrated as you possibly can, and to ripple out these ideas. And, you know, what I'm finding is that quite often, you know, when you start talking about it in a really authentic and genuine way, and not judging anyone or anything, that they go, yeah, you know, it's actually something that I really like, or that's a, like you're saying, a way of life that, you know, we'd like to live too. How do you do it? How can we experience it? Can we learn? And so I think that's what, you know, I guess we've been trying to do. So I have this YouTube channel, and I just put up a whole lot of stuff about how we live and what we do, and a lot of just sort of how-to permaculture stuff there. And there's the blog as well. And also now I run a permaculture educators course. So really trying to offer an opportunity for people to go, well, I'd really like to live that way of life. Because a lot of people said, yeah, I like that, but I, you know, I've got bills to pay. I need to, you know, make a living. And so what I'm doing is a course so that people can learn how to do permaculture, but at the same time learn how to teach permaculture. And so that, as you know, whether they be traveling or in their own gardens or whatever they're doing, be actually cultivating, you know, like a real job doing permaculture. Because I think we need to stop separating our lives, saying, okay, well, that's permaculture over there and that's our hobby, and well, our real life is this, and we have to go and do all this stuff that damages the planet. How can we bring the two together? And so I'm really excited about this as a possibility, that we can try and ripple it out more, because there are so many different ways that we can make a living through permaculture. And I think it's trying to break through too, that this concept that, you know, permaculture can't have anything to do with money. But actually, unless we do think about that, we do have this dichotomy, and we do go and make our money some way that's not necessarily that great, and then come and do this where we feel our heart is and our ethics are. But we can create sustainable, regenerative, ethical enterprises that are able, like what Maya's doing, to be able to give back to the community, to give back to the planet. And so I think it's a really important skill to learn how to weave together our ethical entrepreneurial skills with permaculture and a sustainable way of life, in a way that we can actually, like I was saying, bring together sort of work and life and education, and that we don't have all these sort of silos that we exist in, that we actually live in this integrated world of permaculture permeating everything. And it's a beautiful way of living. Like I said, you know, this has kind of been my life for, you know, well over a quarter of a century now, and my kids are just growing up in. I mean, like I was saying to my earlier, she was prepared, well, I don't know what to say, because I don't know. It just is for her. But when you get her starting to talk, you can hear the amazing stuff that they do. And I just don't think that sometimes they realize that it is different, because, well, why would they realize it's different? Because it just is normal. And so my goal with a lot of the stuff that I do, and running different programs. So we've run Nature Kids programs here. We invite kids to come in and do all different kind of things with us, from eco arts to growing to planting, to just to be in nature, to understand river systems, to meet Indigenous leaders. We ran Young Ethos Scholars programs. So we would, like Mara's talking about, sort of doing sustainable architecture, or, you know, a lot of kids get push down these very pointy wedges of, you know, the best thing to do is to become a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, but not actually think about why or what they're going to do with that once they've done it. And we get a lot of people who come here as sort of refugees, I think, from university. They've graduated and then gone, oh, crap, I don't actually really want to do that with my life. I've got this degree now, but it doesn't really give me what I, you know, I don't know what to do with it in a way that meets how I think. And so what we were trying to do is create programs that would help at a really young age to help to show to people, well, you know, yes, of course, if you want to be an engineer or a doctor or an architect or an archaeologist or a volcanologist or a mathematician, but why? What is the underpinning thing? So, you know, take the ethics. So get involved in architecture and do sustainable architecture, you know. Get involved in engineering and help to design sustainable wastewater systems, for example. And so I think this is a really important thing, because it's one of the things that I saw in Africa. I don't know if you remember that too, Maya, that you ask, when you ask kids what they wanted to do, like the friends that you met, what did they want to do?
Well, the girls always wanted to be lawyers or doctors. And then the boys always wanted to be engineers.
And there was no variation on that, was there? That was the ultimate goal. And I think that's the thing, you know, like, okay, we're heading into education. We're going to get ourselves out of poverty, and we're going to become this and that. And not actually thinking what that means, or what the impact of that is. And well, we can see the impact of it around us. We have become disconnected so much so that we can do these things and not realize, you know, a friend of mine, Helena Norberg Hodge from Local Future, she made the film Economics of Happiness. She talks about how our arms have got so long that we no longer see what our hands are doing. You know, like we eat, but we don't no longer see the impact of the food system. You know, we build houses, but we no longer see the impact of the materials production. You know, before you would make the, like in Africa, everyone there was this 10-year-old kid who was showing me how he made mud bricks. And so I said, so does everyone know how to build houses? Of course. He kind of looked at me as like this odd question. What do you mean, does everyone know how to make bricks? Of course everyone knows how to make bricks. You go into your field, you get the mud, you mix it up, you make it here, you dry it there, then you build it. I was like, what do you mean, how do you make a brick? You know, this whole idea that we've gone so disconnected from our means of living that we just kind of use our money that we earn from whatever it might be to go and buy the stuff. We have no idea about what it's done, where it's been, the impact that it's had. And so I think actually shortening the distance between the producer and the consumer in all different things. We talk about it in food, but in clothing, in there's this great programs now. What's that called? The War on Waste, Maya. And you've watched all of those. The impact of the fashion, the wasteful fashion industry, the impact of, you know, our food system, the impact of our building, the impact of everything really that we do in industrial society. And we need to sort of stop and think about that differently. Anyway, so we run these programs to help, you know, kids really look at that differently. And I don't know how much they get out of it, but I think simply that exposure to these ideas, I think it goes in somewhere. And it's like you're saying, once you see it, it just makes common sense. And I'm hoping that the more that we offer opportunity for kids to be exposed to these sorts of things, they might come from urban environments, but they've seen it. Once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. Once you kind of know something, it's hard to unknow. And so when you ask these questions and you maybe sort of put in these ideas of ethics of what you do, it provides people with a platform to then really reference their whole life around those things and to be questioning and not just to accept stuff straight out as you see it. And, you know, a lot of, you know, there's no kind of KPIs for this kind of stuff, this kind of work. You can't measure it. You don't know the impact that you're having, except when someone comes to you, you know, 15, 20 years down the track, and they said, I remember I came to a camp that you did, you know, 20 years ago, and it changed the whole way that I was thinking about things and what I was thinking about what I was going to study. And you know, it's this ripple effect that happens, and you don't know, you can't plan it. All you can do is seed it. And if you seed everything that you do with this goodwill and this idea of it being this sort of positive and productive and hopeful and regenerative way of thinking and doing, then that's really all I feel like I can contribute, and hope that it just keeps rippling out further and further with each kind of step that it moves.
Yeah, I totally see what you're saying, Morag, and I like how you mentioned that kids who have gone through the you know, the educational systems, and especially you mentioned the refugees, and they feel that they don't want that job anymore that they once dreamed of or wanted, because they can see that it's not supporting the natural environment that supports them. And if you're polluting the food, the water and the air, it's hard to survive here as humans, and all the other animals and, you know, ecosystems too. They need clean food, clean water and clean air. So people, you know, eventually they don't enjoy doing something with, you know, earning money and driving their cars and just surviving in an industrial society that isn't supporting what supports them. And which is why permaculture is so cool, and like I said, that's why it makes sense. And so these kids then, like that you mentioned, you met in Africa right now, you know, they're dreaming, or they're hoping to get this job, you know, the doctor or the lawyer, or these things that Maya mentioned. And But eventually, maybe they'll get those things, or before they even get there, they'll realize that, you know, that's not necessarily what they want. And you can be the herbalist or the naturopath in the eco village, and you can, instead of being a doctor that gives, you know, pharmaceutical drugs to people and charges lots of money because they have a huge debt from a university now. You know, there's other ways to do things that make sense for everyone and still enjoy yourself. Like you said, what you and your family are doing is wonderful, and it's really cool.
I think
did you want
what
to
you
say
just
something?
Mentioned then.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say about debt, because I think that is a huge thing. We're able to live this life because we don't have any debt. And we did that purposely. So as we were building a house, we would gather a little bit of money together and we'd build a bit. And then we'd gather a bit more and we'd build a bit. And we build a house, what we called sort of in buildable, affordable modules. And we never took out a debt, a loan to get into debt. And we're really conscious about doing that because we knew that it would shift and change the decisions that we made and influence them so much that we would choose to do things that we really didn't want to do. And, you know, and also to get a mortgage and things, you'd end up borrowing money from banking institutions that were not so ethical, and you get trapped into this whole kind of economic system, which then usurps your power. You can no longer make the decisions that you want to, and you end up having to work so much longer for such a, you know, like to pay it back, and also to, I don't know, you know, anyway, I think debt, being debt-free as much as possible, have a low debt, gives you your power and your freedom to be able to live this life and to choose and make the decisions to live an ethical life far much, much more easier than if you do choose to sort of, you know. Yeah, and the thing is too that it means that you go, okay, well, instead of having a bigger house and having it all finished at once, it is a smaller house and you build it over time, and that's okay. Or instead of having a fancy car, you kind of get the old secondhand car and choose the most safest, most efficient one that you can, and you know, and make that be your thing. And with clothing, you don't have to buy a whole lot of brand new clothing. There's one or two things that you have which you can kind of rearrange. You can get from secondhand stores or ethical stores, or sew them yourself. In Maya's, you know, started their sewing thing, making clothes for guinea pigs, but you know, she can also sew and do stuff and make her own things if she wanted to as well. So having these skills to meet your needs, and mine knows how to make bread, and she went down to the local baker and learned how to do sourdough, and she knows how to milk a cow, and she knows how to make cheeses and yogurts, and she knows how to plant seeds and grow food and look after chickens and all the basic stuff. You know, I got to being about 20, I reckon, I went, oh, I know how to do some basic stuff, but I really don't know how to meet all my basic needs. I know how to go and do work to get that, but that limits my options because I have to choose, you know, this poor quality clothing that's unethical and it's been made in far-flung places, supporting industries and bad human rights practices. I'd much rather make my own clothing with ethical fabrics or secondhand fabrics, you know, grab some hand store and change it around a bit. You know, like, it gives you this greater sense of freedom to be really kind of much on more on the ethics. And also, if you only need to work one or two days a week for to make a living, then the rest of the time you can actually spend doing community-based work, community service work. You know, like all the work that I did in Africa recently was what I call my community service work. And, you know, it gives you the chance to volunteer and to direct your energy on projects that you feel matter. And it's kind of like a purposeful life. You know, it gives you the chance to really work where you, like, you know, like what you guys are doing, where you put in your energy where you feel that it matters and that what you do is going to make a difference. And so that's kind of the other thing that I, you know, I've talked, why I teach people how to teach permaculture, because I reckon permaculture teachers do make a difference, and they can make a really huge difference in the world. And so as a kind of ethical livelihood, being a permaculture teacher, you know, I reckon it's just an amazing thing to do. I can't imagine doing anything else. I absolutely love it, and you can probably tell. And I really feel like it's something, It doesn't have to be one particular type either. You can be a local community teacher. You can be working in places like Africa. You can, you know, teach in schools. You can teach in a formal environment or an informal environment. You can teach online or you can teach face-to-face. And you can teach in the country or you can teach right downtown on a rooftop garden. It doesn't really matter, but it's about actually having an ethical framework, having a design system that you can share with people so that they can then understand what that means, be able to put it into practice and then ripple it out and keep sharing it. So it's a really accessible and tangible and fantastic way that people can make a living and make a difference simultaneously as having a good life that they're living too. So Kelsey, you're going to say something, I think.
Oh, yeah, this is just wonderful. So lovely to listen to you and Maya. This is great. I've been sharing it all around Facebook so people can listen, and we'll put it on YouTube. And it's just a beautiful picture and experience and view. I grew up in the United States and basically spent most of my time on the East Coast. And we had our gardens and things like this, but what you're sharing is just a wonderful option and better way to live that people can decide to explore and see more for themselves and really discover the natural environment and just themselves, et cetera. It really gives them some time to themselves. So I really appreciate it. And we've had a couple of the kids on our radio show in the past couple of weeks. We had a young man from Italy that was school striking, and we had a young lady from Australia school striking. So the young man, he was 14, the gal was 17, and they were both wonderful kids and had a great vision and just very active and very clear young people paying attention to the environment and what's taking place. And what I found from talking with these kids is that they are not aware of the geoengineering and what people refer to as chemtrails. There's hundreds of U.S. patents on these aerosol sprayings. They spray up to 50 different ingredients. So they use mainly what people are finding in their air, water, and soil is aluminum, strontium, and barium. And they have these geoengineering projects and patents. They call it solar radiation management. And it's actually causing partially the global warming. So I really wanted to put that out there, and I've just been letting the kids know because they are the future and this is their earth and they're the ones speaking up so that they can tell the adults and get the adults to pay attention. And I've seen there's a lot of marketing ploy telling the children that the geoengineering is of a benefit, and it's absolutely not. There's HARP, which is microwaves beaming in the atmosphere, that is also causing the planet to heat up as well. So these are just more factors like the coal that the kids are aware of and the fossil fuels, but there's also more that the governments are not letting people know about. And what I see is that they're going to be rolling it out to where it's like, this is the solution, spraying these aluminum that causes things like Alzheimer's and autism into the sky. So I really appreciate everything you've said so far, and it's just wonderful. I just want to add that. And Africa, we have a lot of friends in Africa too, and we have a few different groups like NUUE, and we actually had the president of that. He was just on, but he might have dropped off. It's about 1 a.m. where he is over there. But there's a lot of wonderful Africans with us as well. And we discovered something called John Ellis Water. And it's an individual in the United States. And he is an engineer, and he read a lot of books like The Alchemist, as an example. And so he finally engineered a machine, and he calls it the Electron 5. It's a machine that heats and boils water, and it's very, very small machine. It's basically like a pot with a hose on the end, and it has a boiler on it, and it heats and boils water hundreds of times. So instead of water being distilled one time, this is happening hundreds of times. And he also found through alchemy that when you do this to water, it will heal the body. We have a video about it on one of our websites, nuwavewater.club. But the reason that I bring it up is because you mentioned Africa and the water there. And John Ellis talks about bringing one of the machines over to Africa where there was an Ebola breakout. So I'm not sure specifically if that was Liberia or where it was. But when they started to use this machine and the people started to drink the water, lots and lots of this water, the Ebola actually disappeared. So just another thing is primary water that people aren't aware of. There's a gal, Deborah Tavares. She's absolutely wonderful on YouTube. She lets people know about the different things that are happening on the earth. So she talks about the 5G and they're cutting down trees for that, et cetera. And she's up in Northern California. She also talks about primary water. She does this great 3-minute presentation, very simple, that she brought to the city council in Northern California about primary water. And then there's another website, primarywater.org, and there's a longer video and more information about this. But basically, it's just water underneath the earth that is absolutely endless, and we really don't have any water shortages, which she's brought out how they're being geoengineered with the HARP and these different cloud seeding projects that they also have. So primary water is something else that's endless and something to discover as well. So I thank you so much, and I'll give it back to Henry.
Yeah, thanks, Kelsey. And another thing about the John Ellis water is that you can actually pour it into a well, and it will change the hydrogen bond angle of the water as well as purify it, because this water has been distilled hundreds and hundreds of times. And so just something like 4 gallons per well, depending on the size of the well, the machine comes with the instructions to do it. It will purify the water in the well, and they've done it in polluted lakes, and you can even do it in a dirty swimming pool, just pour the water in, and it will make it clear again, which might sound a bit out there to some people, but like Kelsey said, there's a very cool 15-minute video on our website, New Wave Water, which is nuwavewater.club. And the primary water, which is really cool too, it's made by hydrogen and oxygen in the Earth's crust. They just merge together and it forms water, and they rise to the surface through things like springs, and that's primary water. And secondary water is the water on the surface, like the rain and the rivers and things like that. So I was going to ask Morag, if you could just share a little bit about how the you said that you have a banking system at Crystal Waters, and you have, like, your own currency?
Yeah. Well, there's a whole lot of there's a whole movement globally called LETS, which is the Local Economic Trading System. So what it means, basically, it gives you the chance to exchange goods and services without exchanging money. So it helps to release resources and help people access services where money might be an issue, or where you don't want to participate in the sort of the monetary system. So basically, it expands the concept of bartering and exchange from being a sort of an individual transaction between a couple of people to being something that you do at a community level. So for example, say I wanted to, I don't know, get a haircut, you'd go to someone and you negotiate a price, and it would be we have bunyas, because bunya is a local seed, an indigenous seed from the bunya pine. You can call it whatever you want. So whatever the local unit is. So say it might be 10 units. So I would pay that person 10 units. And I don't carry around units or nuts or anything. It's just an electronic transaction, a point transaction. And so that person then has 10 units, and they can then go and spend that on whatever they want. They might go and spend 50 units on getting their somewhere else. And so it's just kind of this plus and minus, and it doesn't matter if you're above or below, it all balances out to be zero. So you create all this resources and services and helping people basically without, like, for nothing. And it's an amazing system. If you look it up, it's LETS, L-E-T-S, and there's different forms that you can use as time dollars and all sorts of things, but the one that we use here, interestingly though, so this is a sort of a bioregional system, and it only works at a small scale because there's no point driving a massive distance to go and pay, you know, 10 local units because you've somewhere up in the next Valley, you may as well do it locally. So it's about supporting the local economy and contributing to that. So the thing with the local economy and the local system too is that after it builds relationships and trust between people and helps people understand who does what and what they are and what are some of the gaps, and people start to fill those gaps. So you don't need to necessarily be, you know, the so-called expert in that, but you can find a way to contribute. But what I've noticed is that here at Crystal Waters, like, people just sort of start sharing and trading, exchanging without keeping track of it, because they know after a while what comes around goes around. So it's like I was saying before, it helps people to reactivate a gift economy and a sharing and a shared economy. And we're not talking about, you know, that there's this whole new kind of thing in the global thing around sort of Uber and all of that, which they call the sharing economy. This is actually the real sharing economy, where people are actually really sharing stuff at a local community level and accessing what they can. So we have it's called a complementary currency, and it runs at the same time. So you can even do things, okay, well, you know, if you want to come and do my permaculture course, for example, you know, when I was running the face-to-face ones here, I mostly focus at the moment on online and international ones, but when I was doing courses here locally, people could pay partly in a let system and partly in the normal currency, because I would need to pay hard currency for some things, but there was other things that I could pay other people in local currency. So the two kind of work side by side, which is really very cool as well. Let system, that's what it's called.
Cool, thanks, Morag. I'll be sure to look that up. That's cool. Thanks for sharing. Is Maya still there? I was hoping she could share an experience of... Maya, could you share like one or two just like the most interesting conversations you had with some of the, you know, people around your age when you were in Kenya and Uganda?
Well, I met a few people while I was over there. And one of the people lived in the village, and it was interesting because they had a phone, and they, like, just a small one, but they were living in a farm. And then they would go off to a boarding school in, I don't know, far away in another town called Jinja, and stay there and then come back to the farm for a few months and then go off again. So it wasn't a very local thing for the children. They only got to see their parents a few times a year. And the boarding school, they said, you know, it's nothing like the boarding schools in first world country. They're really bad compared to the other ones. But, like, just the, yeah, it's different.
I think what Maya's trying to say is that there's such a push towards people getting education as a way to move ahead in society that people send their kids away to get a good education, and that, you know, that they don't even see their family or their local community. So right from a very young age, they're split from village, from community, and that, you know, you'll be sitting there in the middle of a village and people have nothing. They don't even have running water. They don't even have maybe stable electricity, but they'll have mobile phones. And so this kind of concept of the pace of development or the unbalanced development and what people are valuing. It is a thing about values, I think, because if you value a sort of a type of education which you hope is going to get you to be an engineer or a doctor, and often what they were sort of saying too was about that if you do something wrong at school, well, you'll end up being the person out there who's digging. So anything to do with farming or food production is a punishment. And so there's this, I think it was, you know, whereas here we're starting to really embrace this whole thing about local food and sustainable communities, and that the village is really important, and we kind of are seeing it. But there's still this great big push. And so I think maybe because Maya's grown up in this whole idea that the idea of local and local food and growing your own food and being part of a community is a good thing, there was this thing about running away from that as fast as they could. But I don't know, what did they say? Did they like go? They didn't like going to those schools, did they?
No, they didn't, but that was the thing that was
expected
of them. So they didn't really have much of a choice. They either did that or become in poverty and digging, which was a bad thing for them, instead of being an engineer or a lawyer or something.
But what about Arafat? There was a young man there called Arafat, and he'd actually made a different choice. He wanted something else, didn't he? And he was going counter to what his parents wanted. His parents wanted him to go and become an engineer and be at a boarding school somewhere away. But he chose to be at this other school because why?
Well, he got a plot of land and he was going to make a farm out of it. So he joined in on the permaculture course and started to learn about that because he wanted to put that into his own community and teach other people.
So, yeah, he wanted to be a new kind of farmer, not a farmer that was stuck to poverty and the Green Revolution and bought seeds, but he wanted to be a farmer that was changing the way things were. So I thought that was a really interesting thing. So there's shifts and changes that are happening, but at the same time there's such a push towards, you know, the development model, and the middle class is growing so rapidly in Africa. So things are really changing very, very fast, and it's such a place of contrast and extremes that it's really kind of hard to get your head around, you know, where things are at. And you know, I think for people who live there too, you know, it's just in a lot of ways there's that daily struggle that if you see an opportunity to make it, you know, get out of that, then, you know, the first thing is to grasp at that and to choose that. But this, even without thinking about this idea of sharing, exchange and community, is there embedded? And, you know, just talking about Uber, I did notice was about how, you know, even if you had a bike and you had a pack rack, you'd put a cushion on your pack rack so you could take someone for a ride, and that would be how you'd earn your money. Or you had a motorbike and you'd have a seat on the back. What are they called?
Bodabodas.
And so you'd pick up anybody and take them, and that would be... So it's a much better way of public transport because they're on every corner and they get you through the traffic really quickly. But the unfortunate flip side of that is these young people, when they inherited land, like what Arafat did, instead of Arafat was keeping his land and he wanted to become a farmer, which most people would never admit to or never want to. Even if they did want to, they wouldn't admit to it because they knew that the way ahead was actually the way they felt or they thought was to follow this other development path. But what other young people doing when they inherited land was to sell it as quickly as they could, buy a motorbike and head to the city and sit on the corner with their mates and wait to give someone a lift. So on one hand, it looks like it's a great, you know, sharing way of doing transport. But on the other side, say if there was some kind of disaster or some, you know, their motorbike broke down or they had a crash and they couldn't use their motorbike. They had nothing. They couldn't earn a living, and they had no place to go back home to grow food, because 75% of the population is still reliant on growing their own food and on farming to actually make ends meet. So there's this transition, this rapid urbanisation, and a shift away from wanting to be dependent on the land. And, you know, you can understand that, but at the same time, throwing everything away is kind of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And we've seen over and over in all the countries that have gone through this rapid urbanisation and rapid development, and there's lessons to be learned from each place to be shared back. And so there's this process called counter-development. It's actually going and talking about what are the lessons that each of these different places have learned along the way, and how can you kind of skip some of those mistakes, and how can you kind of find a new way forward and raise the standard of living and raise the quality of life, but without completely throwing away all the things that really matter, and particularly throwing away the Earth's capacity to support humans and for all species to have the right to exist and for nature to flourish. Because when nature flourishes, so do we. When nature doesn't flourish, we just find struggle and hardship and poverty and, you know, despair. So that was one conversation we had, Maya, but I don't know. I think one of the things that Hugh said to me when he was there, he was like, I sometimes forget that I look the way that I do because it was just us there and we were in the villages and there was sort of no other expats or any other visitors from other countries. It was all just people from local villages and communities. He said, I just feel like I'm the same. You know, there's the same general conversations and the same like needs and wants. And I think that was kind of a really interesting thing. I think that you're all just people. And I think being part of these sorts of programs helps to break those barriers because we often divide people between class and race and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Whereas when you're able to just be able to have the experience to immerse yourself in experiences like that, it stops that from happening and you get to see people for being people, not for being from a certain group. And I think that is a really, really important thing. And it's not something that you hear someone say, it's just something that you feel and you inherently notice without really making comment about it. But I don't know, is there anything else that people said that really stuck in your mind while you were there? She's shaking her head now. She can't think of anything. I'm sure there is, but it's not coming to her mind right now.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, we appreciate it when Maya does like sharing though. And one thing I got from that whole view you both just brought up is how we call them the KEK systems or the world controllers, how they're promoting this industrialized society. And so, you know, all the people that you mentioned, you know, they get land and they want to go and they want to experience this because it seems like, oh, you work and then you have all this money and with all this money you can do whatever you want. But like I said earlier, eventually these individuals, well, some of them, they realize that they're not enjoying destroying the natural environment, which is what the industrial, you know, world is doing. And so they want to go back to do something different. And it's really cool to hear about this one kid you mentioned who doesn't want to do that. And he wants to use his piece of land that he was given. And that is so cool. And in a way, now with with permaculture, without the need of a necessarily like a village like the indigenous people had that they've lost, they can eventually, yeah, have an eco-village, but even before that, the permaculture, they can see how to support the natural environment more so without needing the industrial, you know, seed banks and like huge costs of seeds and fertilizers and all these things. They can have something that supports the natural environment with permaculture and skip the whole experience of going into the cities. And I just got a view of these guys sitting on there on the corners, like you said, with their motorbikes. And, you know, it's actually a lot more fun once you've had that experience to go back to nature and just find things to do, like climb trees and swim in rivers and plant things and just have real conversation like you said Hugh was having with the other children over there in Kenya and Uganda, which is just like children are when they're really young. They're just kind of like being to being, we say, where you're just talking like the other person is just, you know, you're just the same and you're just experiencing life here and just appreciating it too, which is fun. And just another question I'd like to ask Maya, if she's up for it. It's a bit of a fun one. One thing we enjoy here is our dreams at night and paying attention to them and learning from them. And maybe if Maya has any dreams at night or if she had anything different come up while you guys were in Africa.
It's pretty tricky, but I don't know, I just,
I think you stumped her with that question. I don't know if she's got any. Did you dream any different dreams? Did you think different thoughts? Did you have different, what was going through your mind when you?
Or even if you just have some fun dreams that you might want to share from just being at home and, because, you know, you live in a natural environment, so your dreams are probably kind of different to other kids or ourselves here in the city.
Do you remember any of your dreams?
Well, they kind of reflect what I do in the week. So one time I dreamt that there was like a market down at the river. And yeah, it was really weird. But anyway.
What else? What other things?
Like when... I don't know, it's just, it was different from when I was in Africa, because in Africa it was kind of like I was thinking about, because it reflected what I was doing in the day, it was more, more newer concepts and ideas, like, closer housing and stuff, like different landscapes and different.
Okay, sorry guys, I just saw that Morag and Maya have dropped, and so we'll see if we can get them back on. That was fun hearing how Maya, you know, she's had different experiences and her dreams are on the real side while she was in Africa, and how, you know, she has things that reflect what she's going through, what she's doing daily in the Crystal Waters Eco Village. And yeah, it's so cool to hear from Morag and Maya. They've had this cool experience of growing up and being surrounded by nature. Maya her whole life and Morag for so many years. So I just saw that Morag says that they're going to run out of Skype credit if they stay on the phone here. So I think that might be us it for the show today. It's been a lot of fun. We really appreciated Morag and Maya coming on. So a bit of a shame that we used up their Skype credit, and I'll have a chat and offer to reimburse that. But yeah, that was so fun. Anybody that enjoyed that, you can get in contact with Morag. I've put three of her websites are in the description below here, and you can visit our website downunder.strikingly.com. downunderup.strikingly.com. And yeah, that was a lot of fun. You can come along next time. We'll be interviewing more people in Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific, and sharing these wonderful things, or just things that are taking place that you might not know about, that you can become more aware and make better decisions. And yeah, you can decide your life and not let it be decided by others, and just continually become more aware, supporting what supports us.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Henry. And it's really cool to hear the young ladies' experiences of her dreams and how the landscapes were different from where she was living. And it can make a real difference, people's dreams and intuition and their just clearness and vision can open up a lot more when we have a more natural lifestyle in the natural environment, planting, growing with the trees. And it also gives the opportunity when we do have the natural environment supporting us, and we are supporting it by growing foods, etc., then to focus on even more and bring in what we're learning from our dreams. Because Tesla was an individual that really paid attention to his visions and what people call dreams at night, like a lot of people have through history, to bring in something very wonderful and beneficial for the world, like Tesla did with the free technologies and technologies that will actually heal you, instead of a lot of what we have today. So we suggest for people to pay attention to their dreams, to bring in something wonderful for everyone. And one of the easiest, best ways to do this is to simply decide to pay attention. Get yourself a dream journal every morning. You can wake up and you can write down the experiences you have, and eventually you'll start to understand your life and the experiences a little bit better. It's a very beneficial experience and recognition to become aware of these dreams at night and pay attention more in your daily life to the nature, the birds, the bees, the wind, and what the sky is doing. Like, we have these lines in the sky, the chemtrails, etc., and feel the differences in our bodies as well with the water and the foods we're drinking, the sand, the soil we're walking on, and communicate with it. Now, there is a sound I'll share with everyone listening. It's the new you sound, and you can sing this new you. It's a wonderful sound with nature, and children get it very quickly. Singing this new you, new sound before bed, and people's dreams often open up and people start to become more aware. Children have absolutely wonderful experiences and dreams, and we love to share them. So it was a wonderful show with Miss Morag and her daughter, very lovely people, and so fortunate to have people in the world that are doing something real that makes sense and sharing and taking the time to learn more, explore, and let other people know about beneficial ways to support the all-natural environment. And we look forward to seeing Morag and her daughter sharing more for the world and stepping up in a real big way as real leaders and real people. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a great night. Check us out on downunderup.strikingly.com. I'm Kelsey Lynn Brown on Facebook, also on YouTube, and I'm here with Henry Draper. Good night.